They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right. Well, welcome back to the Crossover NBA Podcast. On this episode, we're going to get into all the free agency madness from what the Nets did, revamping their team, kind of historic moment in Brooklyn. The Philadelphia 76ers, they made some substantial changes. How about the Western Conference, where the Utah Jazz and the Portland Trail Blazers both reshaped their roster? A lot happening in this pre-Kawhi Leonard decision episode of the podcast. As always, best way to support the podcast, get over to Apple Podcasts, where you can post a rating or leave a comment. It's easy. It's free. It's the best way to make sure that we keep doing this podcast week after week. Also, if you like boxing, subscribe to the SI Boxing Podcast, hosted by yours truly as well. That podcast also comes out every week. All right, joining me now in studio, two guests this week, which speaks to the substantialness, if that's even a word, of the moment. Sarah Kustok from the Yes Network and FS1, and Rohan Nadkarni, my colleague over at Sports Illustrated. Gentlemen, lady, what's going on?
Nothing. Excited. This has been a busy couple days here, huh?
You have to pause. See, Sarah, you've never done a podcast with Rohan. He always has a glib comment to make at the beginning. So do you have something now, Rohan?
I prefer to refer to it as housekeeping as opposed to glib. But what I was going to say actually this week was, I've just been so busy pounding the pavement on these free agent stories that I don't even have like a thing I need to run by you. You know, we were discussing our potential Tokyo vacation that we're going to take together next year, but I think we could save that for another podcast. You know, I think things are going to slow down by the end of the month, but no, I'm all business today, Chris.
There is a better chance of Tokyo becoming an official state than me taking a vacation with you to Tokyo.
Dude, you say that now. Just give me some time. You'll see.
I said I want to get on this
yeah,
trip.
Yeah.
Dude. I'm also curious, did you have like a scheduling mishap that you asked me and you asked Rohan and then you're like, shoot, they both said yes and now
no,
I can't cancel?
This is such a big day. I want a lot of voices in here.
Okay.
So it's a significant day after a 6-hour flurry in free agency basically cleared the decks of everybody but Kawhi Leonard. So let's jump right in. And Sarah, we'll start right in your wheelhouse, because on Sunday, the Nets completed what I think is one of the most shocking turnarounds in NBA history, signing Kyrie Irving. I should say agreeing to. Nothing can be signed till July 6th. Agreeing to terms with Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant to near-max contracts, adding DeAndre Jordan to the mix, adding Garrett Temple as well, which I think is somewhat significant there. 3 years ago, when Sean Marks took over there, middle of the season 3 years ago, the Nets were a 20-win team with no draft picks the next couple of years because of that deal with Boston. Come 2020, if Durant recovers from his ruptured Achilles, the Nets should be among the favorites to win the NBA championship. So here we are, guys, with an incredible story in Brooklyn. And Sarah, I want to ask you first. You've been around this team for years. Give me some context of where this team was when Sean Marks took over.
Well, it's interesting you ask that, because I think we all can safely say they were dead in the water. I mean, think about the fact that you have no picks for the next couple of years. They didn't have cap room. They didn't have a lot of young players. You looked at where they were at, and it seemed like a really sincerely dire situation. However, when Sean Marks was hired, he had said this. He then hired Kenny Atkinson. They continued to send the message, which to me was genuine. He said, we're not going to worry about the past. We're not going to worry about what we don't have. We're not going to answer questions about the trade or how things have gotten to this point. We're just moving forward with the circumstances that we are in. And they took a very strategic approach. You could see how Sean and his front office, his team, made a lot of just very savvy moves and decisions, you know, year by year and month by month, really. But more than anything, I think people always rolled their eyes at me because they thought, you're just being positive. You're just drinking the Kool-Aid. You're just saying the right things. But the culture is real. And from the moment that Sean Marks took over, top to bottom, what he cared most about was making this feel like a family and making sure that the people that he hired and those he had in place were all bought into the end goal and the big picture. So that's from the front office. That's the performance team. That is the entire coaching staff. It's the type of character and integrity in the players that he brought in. And so all of it in its totality, I think, led up to this. And obviously, this is a tremendous situation, a historic turnaround with where they're at now. But you look at maybe some of the reasons why Kyrie and Kevin Durant chose to come here and add DeAndre Jordan into the mix of, you know, just what this team looks like. But a lot of it, too, is the core of the players that they have, the attractiveness of playing with guys like Caris LeVert, Spencer Dinwiddie, Joe Harris, Jared Allen. So it was all the moves that led up to this. And I just credit to Sean Marks and to his group, or really the organization as a whole, because I do believe it was the small steps that they took, the patience and the approach that they had, but just the brilliance and a lot of the moves that allowed them to be at this point, have the players they have on the roster, but also the room and the space to bring these guys in.
Yeah, and I agree with the core has everything to do with it. And, you know, I get asked all the time about, you know, teams, you know, how they're built and what's the best way to win championships. It's drafting well. Like, that's the foundation of everything. And with none of their own first round picks for a couple of years, and having to sort of pick off the free agent scrap heap and second rounders and all these dark areas, Sean Marks assembled an enviable core. There's, you know, Jared Allen there, like Caris LeVert, who was no sure thing when Sean drafted him late in the first round. Spencer Dinwiddie, who I think is going to be a factor for this team moving forward, who's now under a very good contract. Rohan, this team, and we'll talk about the Knicks later, but, you know, if Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving really were choosing between the Knicks and Nets, this was an easy decision, because the Nets have a team that can win right away, whereas the Knicks do not.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I mean, Sarah and I were talking about this a little bit. You know, from the outside looking in, I mean, I've been writing all year, why would anyone want to sign with the Knicks instead of the Nets? You know what I mean? I mean, look at what Sean Marks has built. It's obvious. And it's kind of cool. It's refreshing in a way to see players kind of realize that, or at least kind of echo the things we've been talking about for a whole year. It is funny. You know, I wrote last September, I had a chance to sit down with Sean Marks in his offense, and he echoed, you know, to me, all the things Sarah was saying. Hey, you know, we didn't have a first round pick. We could control only what we can control. And that is the culture. That's setting the tone. It's funny. I've been trying to write Nets stories all year long. And every time I want to write about Kenny Atkinson, they're like, you know, Kenny doesn't really like to take credit away from the front office. And anytime I write about Sean Marks, you know, Sean doesn't really like to take credit away from Kenny. It's really remarkable what they've built there. I will say something that is a little funny to me, and just to show kind of how fragile these situations are, the Knicks and Nets, it's not been exactly the same, but obviously they were both targeting this summer, right? They both wanted to clear the decks for this summer. It's so difficult to put these plans together. I mean, the Nets were a Tyler Johnson contract away from not having the cap space this summer. You know, the Heat kind of matched that deal, and people were like, what are you doing? You know, these things hinge on so many little decisions that, you know, it's not that Sean Marks made the perfect move at every single turn, but they deserve so much credit for putting themselves in this position. And just as a fan of the NBA, it's refreshing to me to see a team like Brooklyn be rewarded for the way they went about building this. You know, I wrote for SI this morning. Another, I think, huge, you know, takeaway from Kyrie and KD going to Brooklyn is teams don't have to tank to re-enter contention. I think that's a good thing for the NBA. You know, Sean Marks never has done this without a single one of his own first-round picks. It's remarkable. None of the picks he's made have been picks that came from the Nets or Brooklyn-owned picks. It's picks that he traded for. The fact that he was able to build this team without tanking, they couldn't tank. I mean, they had no reason to. They didn't have any of their first-round picks. Kenny Atkinson was given the freedom to coach these guys as hard as he wanted to develop players. And I think that's encouraging for the league moving forward, that not only can general managers point to Brooklyn as a reason to say, hey, we don't need to tank, but players are recognizing we don't need to go to the Knicks just because they're the Knicks. We can go to the team that has actually been you know, competitive the last couple of years.
And I also think, to add on to that, Mannix, like, we talk about small moves or the little things or teams that do the little things. There's going to be a lot of guys here that made an impact with this that won't be on the roster anymore. Mm-hmm. And it just being smart about bringing in veterans like Damari Carroll and Ed Davis, Jared Dudley, those that helped along some of these young guys to get to the point of where they're at, that they may not be reaping the benefits of whatever this roster may look like moving forward, but they were a major part of that. And identifying those guys, that can help you do that. And then also just we know there is word of mouth in small circles within the NBA and just priorities of taking care of your family, taking care of wives, girlfriends, sisters, brothers, you know, what they do in the background, and they don't want to publicize and they don't worry about making sure everyone knows. But the players know that it's them first and foremost as people. And again, that sounds like a lot of talk, but when it's real and when players feel it and then they go back and tell others, I do think those are just like the small details that sometimes get overlooked. But when they're there, they matter when it comes to bigger decisions.
Yeah, I think that's right on all counts. And Rohan, to your point about the non-tanking, the NBA has got, I think, the strongest argument right now against teams tanking, because the draft lottery and the flattening of the odds, it basically worked. You know, you had two non-tankers in New Orleans and Memphis wind up with the top two picks, whereas the Knicks, they still got inside the top three, but that's not where they wanted to be. And the Phoenix Suns fell all the way down to six. Those were two teams that were basically mailing it in for most of the season. And you have culture mattering. Building a winning culture, even if it doesn't put you in to that top three or four slot, it pays dividends when free agents look at you and say that team is built to win, whereas this team just has gobs of cap space. So I think it's a great argument. Now, Sarah, when I talk to different executives and scouts about, you know, this whole thing working, it always comes back to Kyrie. And you and I have had this conversation about how Kyrie might fit in with a team that, at least for next year, is basically Boston light. Like, they're a young group of guys that achieved some measure of success last year, and now you're injecting Kyrie Irving into the mix. And the question is, will Kyrie accept it and be a positive influence on that team, or will it be Boston 2.0, where you have Kyrie being a disruptive force and his leadership being as bad as it was in Boston? So let me start with the Kenny Atkinson angle of all this. You know Kyrie Irving, you know Kenny Atkinson really well. How do you see their styles and their personalities meshing together?
See, I think it's because I've been around Kenny. It's because I've seen how he's related to a multitude of different players. And I say this in a vacuum of Kenny, and not because I have all the respect in the world for Brad, and I think he is just one of the absolute best. So I say this strictly speaking about Kenny Atkinson. He's got a relatability and a sincerity to him, a genuineness and a fierceness in how he competes, but how he loves you as a player and as a person in figuring out ways to get the best out of everyone. And he goes hard at everyone. And so whether it's practices, he treats every single player 1 through 15 the exact same. And I think there is a, you know, and for Kyrie, I imagine there has been conversations, whether I know Kyrie and Spencer Dinwiddie know each other really well and have talked about coming there and playing there. And Kenny and Spencer have an extraordinary relationship. I know that there has been conversations heading into this that there should be an expectation of how this is going to work. But when it comes to Kenny, it's his ability to recognize and understand how he could make you a better player, but also fit into the context of what they're trying to do in general. And I think the different caveat of this is the first time Kyrie is choosing where he wants to be. This is, you know, it's not through a trade. It's not being drafted. This is Kyrie saying, I have a multitude of options, and this is the place where I feel comfortable. And it seems like something that he has thought about for a long time, and had a good amount of time to see what the roster looks like. And I know what you're saying, and I think a lot of people make a comparison about Boston and Brooklyn and the rosters and young guys, and they've had some success. Like, I don't look at it as apples to apples. Like, to me, it's not the same type of comparison. You could just say, oh, Caris LeVert, like Jason Tatum, and what, Joe Harris, like, who would you, I don't think the rosters are necessarily constructed in the same manner or the understanding of roles or how it all fits. So I have a high level of optimism that they'll work this out and figure this out, and how they make it work will be under the pretense of this is Kyrie's choice, and they are going to make sure to put him in the best position possible to succeed. But in doing so, it's more about the buy-in, which it's been for all of these guys and why they've found success, about the buy-in of we're going to do everything that's best for the team.
Yeah, I just want to hop on that for a second, because I love Kenny Atkinson. I'm a big fan. I think he's one of the most underrated coaches in the NBA right now. I know Mannix is part of this Brad Stevens brigade, and he wants to, you know, put up his Twitter polls and whatnot. Well, meanwhile, Kenny Atkinson is here, and just the job he's done developing guys like Spencer Dinwiddie, like Caris LeVert. You know, there were all sorts of labels attached to D'Angelo Russell when he got to Brooklyn that were, you know, maybe unfair, but Kenny Atkinson, you know, it took that and turned him into an all-star. I do have concerns, isn't the right word, but I'm intrigued to see how this goes forward. Not necessarily from a tactical standpoint, but one thing that is interesting to me is Kyrie and KD didn't seem to, they're not doing what Kawhi did, right? They didn't take their time. They didn't take a lot of meetings. They didn't let teams woo them. That is an interesting aspect of this decision to me. I think in many ways it was smart for them to go to Brooklyn over, you know, the other teams in the market looking for two free agents. Having said that, how long did they carefully consider factors like coaching? Something that has developed into, in my opinion, a market inefficiency almost in the NBA is the relationship between superstars and their coaches. We saw it to a degree in LA last year. I mean, would they have been a better team if LeBron and Luke Walton got along, if Rich Paul wasn't going to the commissioner of the NBA to complain about LeBron's coach? You know, Durant in Oakland, I don't think necessarily meshed well with Steve Kerr. Obviously, they made it work and they had a lot of success, but there were times where Durant was even kind of publicly rebutting Kerr. I think if you just look at over the last 15 years of the NBA, the teams that have had the most success, even if there was friction, they had those relationships between the stars and the coaches, whether it's been Steph and Steve Kerr who are harmonious, whether it was Phil, you know, finding a way to make Kobe and Shaq work for as long as he did, obviously Greg Popovich with Tim Duncan for so long. Those relationships are important. I'm not saying that Kyrie's a bad guy or Durant is a bad guy or they're uncoachable or whatever. I'm just interested to see what happens, because they didn't have that long process where it seemed like, hey, we're weighing Fizdale versus Atkinson or whatever those conversations end up being. So I'm kind of interested to see how that plays out.
Yeah, it will be interesting. And Sarah, to your point, I think that Kyrie choosing his destiny for really the first time in his career, I mean, he did sign the long-term contract with Cleveland, but everybody signs that first long-term extension. Then he had LeBron thrust on him, and then he was traded to Boston. This is the first time where he has gone out and chosen his own destination. I also think that the specter of Durant and the fact that Durant will be coming back and part of this process at some point, most likely in 2020, 2021, I think that's going to keep everything kind of in perspective for Kyrie Irving. So I don't think it'll be it'll be bad. I think that I'm very interested to see how Kyrie handles Kenny, because I know they're not the same, you know, Kenny and Brad Stevens, but they're both guys, and Sarah, correct me if I'm wrong here, but they're both guys that place a pretty big value on the regular season and getting better every single game. And that wasn't something that Kyrie took well to in Boston. Like, he comes from a culture in Cleveland where the regular season was like an annoyance. So I don't know, Sarah, like that's one part of this, like that, where I could see some butting of the heads there, where Kenny's got all these young guys he's still trying to develop, and Kyrie's kind of like, well, all right, let's just get to the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think that I see what you're saying there, but I also think just that priority of getting, but like, to me, sometimes it's and I don't know Kyrie enough to know this or understand, you know, his day to days. But like these guys, to me, it's also the influence of other players, like develop, like everyone can always get better. Everyone always should be as engaged in development throughout the course of whether it's a season, an off season, career. And so to me, sometimes I feel like that feeds into, it's not just your head coach saying, okay, we want to go out and win this game because we need to get better. Like, a lot of it too is the players around and when they're showing up and the work they're putting in and being there. I mean, spending all summer in Brooklyn and their concern about improving their game. So, I mean, I see what you're saying, but to me, that does not seem like the biggest hurdle. To me, that doesn't seem like the biggest sense of concern of being engaged on a day-to-day basis. However, that's, you know, that's something you'll see how it plays out.
I got it. Yeah,
and let me just say this, Rohan. Let me turn to you on DeAndre Jordan being part of this. Like, this is a lesson, kids, to be best friends with star players down the line. I mean, 4 years and $40 million for DeAndre Jordan on a team that already has Jarrett Allen, Rohan, is a hell of a deal for DeAndre Jordan. That guy's going to finish his career with a lot of money in his pockets. And this last contract, I think he's going to owe a big thank you to Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving.
Yes, this was like a definitely some kind of weird tax that Brooklyn had to pay, that any team, I guess, that wanted these guys had to pay. Was, and listen, I think DeAndre Jordan, obviously, you know, he had a rough year, I think, last year, but I think being in a situation like this will bring out the best in him and maybe, frankly, get him to try a little bit harder, rotating to the rib and stuff like that. It was a weird situation, but that just seemed like a tax that any team who signed these guys was going to have to pay. Here's, honestly, I think maybe my weird biggest concern about this current setup in Brooklyn. And obviously, when both these players are healthy, they're going to be great. And I'm not worried about how they fit offensively or anything like that. But Durant missing this first year is something that we're all going to have to reckon with at some point. I mean, I'll be shocked if he plays at all this season, considering when the Achilles tear happened. Like, that opens the door for some weird things to happen. I mean, it's not analogous, but we just saw a situation in Boston where, like, Hayward missed the first year and then it was really awkward, you know, coming back. What if, like, let's say the Nets win, like, are incredible this year and all of a sudden are defying expectations and are playing really well. How excited will Kyrie be to then welcome Durant back in the fold? We're now getting all these stories about Durant, you know, I was underappreciated in Golden State and I was tired of playing second fiddle to second Stephen Curry. And I'm just really interested to see the star dynamics play out, because Durant missing this first year adds just like a layer of bizarreness that I don't think we've ever seen anything like this before in the NBA. And I think anyone who's saying they know exactly how it's going to go is lying, because they're both have proven to be, up until this point in their careers, mercurial personalities at times. And that doesn't mean they are bad players or bad people in the locker room. They're just different. They're different than what we've grown accustomed to. I think what players around them have grown accustomed to. But that, to me, is a underlying, you know, kind of factor in this whole marriage. Is like, Durant's going to miss this first year, and that is going to lead to some consequences, I think, that we haven't fully thought through yet.
Yeah, I don't know that we look. I think Kyrie wants Durant there, if for no other reason than it takes an enormous amount of pressure off his shoulders, not just as a player on the floor, but in the locker room. One thing we've learned from the Boston experience, that Kyrie doesn't want to be kind of the go-to guy in that locker room. And not everybody's built that way. I mean, you know, Sarah experienced Darren Williams, who's not built that way either. Some guys just built to try to be great players and that's it. And Kevin Durant, he would immediately take ownership, I think, of that team. And I think that's something that Kyrie Irving would want. Let me ask you this, Sarah, on the flip side of, as some of the fallout, D'Angelo Russell, who we knew was going to get a big deal, he winds up part of a sign and trade with the Warriors. He gets a 4-year max level deal from Golden State. I could have sworn, if you had asked me a day before the start of official free agency, I thought Russell was going to Minnesota. And moreover, Minnesota thought Russell was going to Minnesota.
I think judging by Carl Anthony Towns' social media Twitter account,
I can't figure out exactly what happened there, but it was something, Sarah. Something went weird, went haywire, that made D'Angelo Russell decide to go forward with the sign and trade involving the Warriors. What did you make of all that and Russell's fit now in Golden State?
This continues to go back to, and Mannix, you may be tired of hearing it from me, I really am such a big fan of D'Angelo, and I don't know if it was, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not sure if the max was going to be on the table if he went to Minnesota, if that was a factor. I'm not sure if location and where he wants to be would factor into that. We know that D'Angelo Russell is good friends with Karl Anthony Towns, but overall, I like the fit with Golden State, just because given the circumstances of Klay Thompson being out for the early part of the year, D'Angelo Russell, I like what he could do next to Steph Curry. To me, it's hard to find a player that I don't think would fit well next to Steph Curry, but just his ability to play, make, to create, he can play. He didn't do it as much at times throughout the course of the season last year with Brooklyn when he was on the floor, and some of that was out of necessity, but he could play off the ball really well. He's a good spot-up shooter. I'm sure there's aspects of his game that he will need to adjust a little bit or will be adjusted based on how Golden State wants to play, but for a team that was probably in need of some scores, in need of someone to take off some of that load and responsibility of what Steph Curry is going to be under heading into this next year, I like him being there. And I think, you know, if that was a place that he wanted to be at and he wanted to go to, I mean, this all circles back to Brooklyn trying to do right by him as well and get him to the place where he potentially ultimately wanted to be.
Yeah, I personally see this as a very short-term relationship between D'Angelo and Golden State. I think D'Angelo Russell is a very good player. The issue with him in Golden State is you're paying him a max salary and you're getting a little bit of a muted version of him. I mean, Tom Haberstroh wrote a great story. D'Angelo Russell ran as many pick and rolls by himself last year, almost as many as the entire Warriors team. I mean, Golden State uses pick and roll less than any other team in the league. So, you know, now the Warriors kind of have these weird options. Are you going to let D'Angelo, you know, run a lot of pick and rolls and then Steph doesn't get to beat Steph as much? Or do you have D'Angelo off the ball? Like Sarah said, he's a very good off the ball player, but that's not you maximizing his talent necessarily either. So I see this as kind of a short-term marriage. I think offensively they can make it work. Defensively, I think you're going to have a lot of problems with the Steph D'Angelo backcourt. I mean, they both compete on that end, but they're just at a size disadvantage most nights. I don't love D'Angelo, Steph, and Klay playing together either. I think what you're going to see happen is if and when Klay returns, if that's around the trade deadline, whether it's the deadline or next summer, I think D'Angelo is going to end up on a different team because the Warriors are going to need, you know, multiple bodies at that point. And I think for Russell, what's best for him in the long term is to, I think, be on a team that's on a more congruous timeline. I mean, I don't think he needs to be on a team with all these vets right now. I also think he needs to be in a little bit more of a starring role. He's proven that he can carry that load as he did in Brooklyn last year after Caris LeVert went down. I like the fit in Minnesota a lot. So I do think eventually we'll see these guys go their separate ways. But in the short term, it makes sense for both sides, for D'Angelo to go to a good team, you know, instead of getting stuck in, you know, a situation where he's just signing with a team with cap space, but not necessarily getting to, you know, to play on a contender. And then for the Warriors, I think, listen, they just need bodies at this point. It makes sense for them to go this route, but it's crazy how quickly Golden State has changed. That turnover has been fast and furious there.
Yeah, I would take the under on the 4 years of Russell playing in Golden State. I mean, they do need bodies now with Iguodala gone, with Klay Thompson gone, with Kevin Durant gone. I mean, somebody's got to go out there and make sure it's not Steph going 40-plus minutes every single night. But when Klay comes back, I don't know. I've talked to a few scouts that think it could be pretty dynamic with Klay, but Klay's better as a two-man defender and as a two-guard in general, and Russell's not big enough to play the three. I don't love that fit there, but I think there'll be a market for Russell that's pretty big. I just question, if you're D'Angelo Russell, and maybe Sarah's right, maybe the money, you know, was a factor in all this, but you would get to choose your kind of destiny by going to Minnesota. You would play with a close friend in Karl-Anthony Towns. You would play, you know, for a good young coach in Ryan Saunders. You would have a strong front office there now with Gerson Rojas in the mix. He might wind up traded to like Sacramento in a year. And then he wouldn't have any control over his career and where he goes. So that's the only question there. I think it makes some sense for Golden State to have him as well. But for D'Angelo Russell, I wonder if he winds up regretting it at some point.
Was it realistic for Minnesota to pull that off cap-wise?
That's what I would... I'm not sure if it was one realistic cap-wise and what they would actually even be able to give him.
Right, because if you're Brooklyn, you're not... as much as they want to do right by D'Angelo, I don't think they're necessarily incentivized to like take on Jeff Teague or anything like that. So I agree that Minnesota would have been a good fit. And obviously we saw the return of the sign-and-trade this summer, and that's awesome and it's hilarious. But I don't know how realistic it would have been for him to kind of work his way there.
Well, something happened, And again, I don't know exactly what it was probably
teams realizing that they don't want to take on Andrew Wiggins' contract.
I don't know. No, I don't know if it was that, but something happened, whether it was on Russell's side or some kind of cap clearing deal that fell apart. I'm not exactly sure what happened there, but I know the Timberwolves are bitterly disappointed right now that they don't have D'Angelo Russell. Rohan, let me ask you this. The Knicks, who are going to go into next season with Kevin Knox and RJ Barrett and a whole bunch of guys signed on short-term deals, how bad do the Knicks look in the aftermath of everything that happened with Kyrie and Kevin Durant?
Oh my God, this Steve Mills statement, that was so sad. I was like just about getting ready to like literally in the process of like crafting a tweet, I was like, let me give like a half-hearted defense of the Knicks right now. It's so easy to pile on them. And then they just like released this. Since when did like general managers start apologizing for not signing guys? I'd never seen anything like that before. That was absurd. That was sad. I wish he hadn't done that. Listen, it's bad for the Knicks, and obviously they're getting a lot of criticism right now for not even, you know, kind of stealing the Sean Marks strategy of taking on, you know, questionable contracts and accumulating picks. I do think that's easier said than done. There aren't like a ton of guys on there whose deals line up perfectly with 2021 free agency that teams are looking to dump that the Knicks can just kind of absorb. One thing that we just spent like the first 10 minutes of this podcast talking about the benefits of being competitive headed into free agency. And granted, I don't think this Knicks roster is now like, you know, going to be scrappy or anything along those lines or perfect, but at least they're signing NBA caliber players. I mean, Julius Randle is good. I like Julius Randle a lot. I'm interested, you know, can we get a healthy season from Elfrid Payton? They did sign so many big men, which worries me a little bit when Knox and Mitchell Robinson, I think, should kind of be their 4-5 combo. I am interested in like a Knox-Julius Randle front court. Taj Gibson, I think, is a good veteran to have there for their young guys. So that is my half-hearted defense of the Knicks. It's very easy to pile on them. It's very easy to say they should be taking contracts and accumulating first-round picks. We've seen one of those deals. Two, I guess, with Iguodala, but you know, that was maybe a little bit more complicated. We're not seeing a ton of guys just being dumped for picks right now. So, you know, the Harkless thing, I think, was a last-minute twist that happened. Maybe it was difficult for New York to get involved there. So I do like their idea of let's put a team on the floor next year. Let's not try to be aggressively bad and see if now we can kind of attract people. The real mistake, I think, and I talked about, I was literally on a plane on my way back from Mumbai, somewhere over Azerbaijan when I wrote this, but trading Kristaps Porzingis was the big mistake they made. There was no reason for them to do that. He was going to be a restricted free agent. I understand that people, you know, really, I would have been shocked if Kristaps Porzingis, with his injury history, took a qualifying offer from the Knicks this summer. I mean, they should have called his bluff, in my opinion, or see if they could have convinced him to return. Maybe they really wanted to get him out of there, but I think that to me is their biggest mistake, more so than anything happened this summer. Just literally a salary dump of the best player they've had there in years. That to me is what stands out about that.
And I think the vocalization of that they were getting someone based yes. off of that. So I think I totally agree. And sorry to cut you off, Mannix, but Rohan, like if you're looking at what they did and what the roster looks like and guys, like I like it, and they are, and they fit well in how Fizdale wants to play. And you got a lot of solid guys that, you know, I think are going to be competitive. It's more about looking at it as the aftermath of the trade of Porzingis and saying that you're going to definitely get guys and yeah. thinking you're going to get Durant and Kyrie or the Kawhi aspect, or, you know, then thinking you're going to get Kevin. I feel like it's all of those things rolled into one. But if you just actually look at where the roster sits, there's a lot of nice pieces that you can at least be positive about. And then also contracts that you can get off of in a year yeah. or two if there's people out there that you could sign or trade for.
And maybe someone trades a first round pick for Julius Randle. I mean, they have movable deals too that they have guys, you know, Bobby Portis, someone may want him at some point. So it's not all doom and gloom. It's bad. It's not good, but it's not, you know, apocalyptic.
No, it's not. And look, if they weren't going to get somebody with Durant, I actually agree with the assessment that we don't, you know, want to go out there and or at least James Dolan's assessment that they don't want to go out there and give him a max level contract, because they're on a ton of pathways to get better over the next couple of years. The 2020 free agent class is projecting to be pretty weak. So if you couldn't get Kevin Durant plus one, this isn't the worst way to go, because now they've signed these guys to contracts that do not bleed into that 2021 season. They can develop RJ Barrett. They can develop Kevin Knox. They can do, frankly, what the Nets have been trying to do over the last few years with maybe better young pieces, because Barrett looks like, by all accounts, a potential franchise player at that position. So it's not bad, but I agree with both of you guys. The Porzingis trade just looks worse and worse every single day. They can spin out there all they want that Porzingis was not going to sign that max contract, but for like months, if not years, before then, every time I brought like a Porzingis gripe to the attention of somebody in the Knicks organization, what I would hear back was, come on, like this guy understands the value of being a New York Knick. Like he knows that his brand is only going to grow exponentially if he is a member of the New York Knicks. So they never really took any kind of whether it's threats or grumbling, all that seriously. Then all of a sudden, he's coming off a knee injury and he's going to turn down a 5-year max level deal. How quickly did he take that deal with the Dallas Mavericks? Like, right away, he accepted that deal from Dallas. So I don't buy any of that, any of that at all. And
I do,
the guy.
I do wonder, not to get into like full speculation conspiracy mode and like make anyone like say something they're going to regret in a second, but let me just say that I would not. There's going to be some kind of Porzingis story that comes out, whether the Knicks are like trying to like cover their ass or something like that. Something is weird here that they just gave up on him in the way they did. Either literally, like, they had a promise from an agent that said, do this, trust me, it's going to happen. Something weird happened here. I don't know what it could be about him. And again, this is the most kind of reckless speculation you could have on a podcast. But it just, from a basketball standpoint, as dumb as the Knicks have been over the years, to just salary dump someone like him truly makes no sense. I think there's got to be more to this story, personally, but that is the worst kind of reckless speculation you could have.
I mean, there might be, but like, I mean, who knows? I mean, they clearly thought they'd be big players in free agency, and this is where their owner looks even worse. I mean, James Dolan going on the radio and basically saying that agents have been whispering in his ear that they're going to bring their players to New York.
And James Dolan's,
that just looks worse and worse.
Listen, in James Dolan's defense, those same agents were like whispering in a lot of people's ears because there was a reason why everyone had penciled in Kevin Durant to the Knicks. There were that didn't just conjure up from like our, you know, trade machine fantasies. And yes, Dolan sounded stupid saying that, but there's reason why. You know, every time, you know, Chris, you and I go on a radio show or we're on In the Paint or we're on Crossover TV and we're doing our little predictions, there are reasons why everyone thought Kevin Durant was going to the Knicks. And it's because of those whispers. And it's because of whispers of people around him. So, yes, Dolan sounded like an idiot. He shouldn't have said that. But there are reasons why him and everyone else was saying those things.
Yeah, I mean, that's fine. But he's the owner. He shouldn't be saying yes. Anything. Like that radio interview is now part of the James Dolan lore and part of his narrative moving forward. All right, let's move forward here. Let's talk about Philadelphia, the other Eastern Conference team that has reshaped its roster. The Sixers, they decided to pull the plug on the Jimmy Butler experiment after less than one season. They sign and trade him with Miami. They get Josh Richardson back, who's a terrific defender for their lineup. They add Al Horford to the mix. You know, it's basically if you can't beat him, sign him, you know, with Al Horford, because they had a lot of problems, you know, with Joel Embiid being defended by Horford. They pull him off Boston. They have revamped their team, and they're now, you know, reportedly, according to Woj, about to sign Ben Simmons to a long-term extension. This is their group now. Like, there's not a lot of wiggle room in terms of contracts, not a lot of wiggle room in terms of trades. Sarah, what do you think of where Philadelphia is now versus where they were at the end of this past season?
They're going to have a nasty defense, I'll tell you that much. I mean, I know that was part of their strength last year. But I like the moves that they made. And for whatever, I know with the... with Jimmy Butler, he became, and we really saw it throughout the postseason, he was their closer. Like, he was their go-to guy. They put the ball in his hands, and he made such a difference and an impact in what they were able to do in the playoffs, which, you know, for me at least, it led me to wonder, like, oh, is he going to be the guy that they're going to make sure to try and lock down? What priority will that be? However, I felt like Jimmy, you know, wanted to be in Miami, wanted to move on. So with that being said, I like the way their roster looks. I'm a huge fan of Josh Richardson in with Miami. And we know he's a guy that's Bolster loved and came up through their G League ranks and just, you know, a two-way player. His offense is improving. His shot's improving. But I like matching him with a player like Ben Simmons. I'm the biggest advocate of Al Horford. So I think the little things that he could do for that team, and just in term of, and Chris, you know this better than anyone, so, you know, you could speak to this, but just with that locker room and just continuing to try to meld some of those strong personalities together. And I also think, you know, a guy like they even, you know, keeping Mike Scott, I think, is good. Like, I think he was a good, solid guy off the bench that can knock down shots, a good veteran, the toughness that he brought. I think they signed Kylo Quinn, too. But just my question will be, as we continue to move forward, which I think everyone has, what will Ben Simmons come back and look like? What will Joel Embiid come back and look like? And who's their closer? Who's the guy at the end of the game, push comes to shove, is it Ben Simmons that has the ball in his hands, or is he playing in that dunker spot again, or what, you know? So how does that all manifest itself? But I think that's all very good questions and problems to have if you're Philadelphia, because this roster as it stands, and the starting lineup at least as it looks, is one to me that is very impressive, and, you know, looking at one of the top teams in the East as it sits so far.
Yeah, it's probably, I mean, it's one of the biggest starting lineups, or probably will be, that I've ever seen, with, you know, a 6'10" point guard in Ben Simmons. But Rohan, it's Simmons that I come back to. I mean, Tobias Harris getting the max contract, that's fine. Great teammate and a guy that can make shots from the outside. But Sarah mentioned the closer aspect of this. And Ben Simmons is going to have to come back next year with the ability to take over games off the dribble and make plays in the fourth quarter. That was Jimmy Butler's responsibility. Ben Simmons is also going to have to come back and I think prove to be at least a threat from beyond the three-point line. They lost J.J. Redick too, and J.J. Redick was such an integral part of what they did offensively last year that they're going to struggle, I think, finding ways to replace him. I mean, Al Horford is a terrific pick-and-pop player, but he's not a great three-point shooter, only in the mid-30s from three-point range. So he's not this sniper from the outside. So they may be able to overwhelm teams physically, but in the playoffs, you've got to have somebody there that can get a bucket and score at the free throw line in the fourth quarter. Jimmy Butler was that guy for them last year. Ben Simmons, to me, has to come back as that guy next year.
Chris, I have so many thoughts about the Sixers. So, you know, I'm moving to Los Angeles in a month, and I'm doing this thing where I'm trying to go to every New York restaurant that I've wanted to go to, right? And one of them is called Great New York Noodle Town. It's in Chinatown. And I'm looking at their menu, and I'm like, man, the scallion pancakes look awesome. Man, the barbecue pork looks awesome. Man, maybe I get the mapo tofu. I don't know. I've never been there. I have just so many options. That, to me, was Philly this summer, right? They had so many options. It's like, what do we do? We can bring back Tobias Harris, Jimmy Butler, and J.J. Redick and run it back. We can max Jimmy Butler and let Tobias Harris walk. We can, you know, max Tobias Harris, trade Jimmy Butler, and then sign Al Horford. It's like, what do we do? It's like, we got so many options. And they had to choose, right? At some point, you have to choose, and it's so terrifying. I do not envy Elton Brand as a general manager who at some point has to choose. But let me say this. Philadelphia's starting five last year. I should have been like Sarah and come to this podcast with a lot of research and a lot of notes, but it was manic, so it wasn't that important, so I didn't. But Philadelphia's starting five with Ben Simmons, J.J. Redick, Tobias Harris, Jimmy Butler, Joel Embiid was smoking teams. That lineup was smoking the Raptors. The Sixers lost the eventual NBA champions because Joel Embiid was sick, okay? Joel Embiid's plus-minus in the second round was absurd. Like, Philadelphia just got killed whenever he wasn't on the floor. And then even that, it took four bounces on this insane shot to beat Philly. There was such a good argument for them to just run this back completely. Give Brett Brown one whole season with the same team. I mean, look at how many times Brett Brown had to reinvent this team on the fly last year. First the Jimmy trade, then the Tobias trade, then Embiid gets hurt. And they were thinking about firing him. I couldn't believe it. I mean, Brett Brown had to deal with so much last year. If they had maybe just given him a full year with this team, I understand, you know, there's now conflicting reports. Did they even offer Jimmy the full max? Or did they even offer Jimmy 4 years? Did they offer Jimmy the full max and he turned them down? To me, you know, Philly, they just had to make a choice, and I don't know that I love the one they had. I do think defensively they're going to be great. You know, I was talking with some other colleagues of ours. They brought up a good point to me, which is you can get away playing two bigs if the Warriors aren't the favorites anymore. You know, it had to be the last 5 years, if you were a contender and you took yourself seriously, you had to have a counter for these small ball lineups. I do think we're maybe entering a part of the NBA where small ball isn't as, you know, requisite for success in the past, and that's good for a team like Philly. And first of all, or not first of all, but I just want to throw out there, Josh Richardson, that's a great get. I mean, he was miscast as kind of a lead scorer in Miami. He's going to be great. He's not a J.J. Redick level shooter, but he's a very good shooter from the outside. You know, Rob Mahoney, I think, had him third team All-NBA defense, great defender. He's going to slot in nicely there. But I think they're going to have problems in the half court. You mentioned Horford's not a sniper. Teams lead, the Bucks left him in the pick and pop. They let him take those threes. Tobias Harris is going to be, you know, their small forward. He's going to have to guard, you know, some of the best perimeter players. I have some questions about how it's going to work half court offensively, and I'm a little bit worried about their athleticism defensively, even though they have great individual defenders all over the floor.
Real quick, Mannix, I all think this comes back to, which all of us, Ben Simmons, and what type of player does he come back with? Is he a guy, he didn't have to be highly efficient, but is he a guy that will even take shots from the perimeter, and how can that change the complexion of what they do in their half-court offense?
Yeah, I would agree with everything that was just said there. And look, this is not a team that you can, again, you could split apart very easily now. Like, they've got a bunch of guys on some huge contracts. I do think, to kind of put a button on the Jimmy Butler stuff, it just didn't work. Like, I know on the court it looked like it was fine, but everything I was told, it just the mix wasn't right down there with Jimmy Butler. And Jimmy Butler wants to be have his own team. Like, Jimmy Butler wants to be the man, and I don't know if he's capable of carrying a team deep into the playoffs without significant help, but he thinks he is, and he's going to get the opportunity to do that in Miami, you know, playing there as kind of the alpha with that group. I think that was a big part of Jimmy Butler's mindset going into free agency. All right, let me ask you guys about just a few of the other teams. We don't have to go through team by team here, but the team with the most notable notable last few days of free agency, the most interesting team out there to you, as the dust has settled on basically everyone but Kawhi Leonard, was who? Sarah, we'll start with you.
Can I have two?
Yep. Take as many as you want.
One, this is just for you. I'm really excited about the Bucks having both Lopez brothers.
Amazing.
Nice pickup of Wes Matthews. But yeah, I wish I was a fly in the wall watching those two together in practices in the locker room and all sorts of things. I think it's going to be an absolute delight. But in all reality, Utah. I'm excited, and Mannix, I know you brought, like, I'm excited to see what Utah looks like. Love the pickup of Conley. Can't wait to see what he looks like in Donovan Mitchell playing alongside a player like, and obviously Ricky Rubio. Credit to him for what he did, but he is not the same type of player that Mike Conley is, so I'm excited for how that works. Ed Davis, of course, who I was so impressed with in his time in Brooklyn last year. You just add a player like that on. Of course, Bojan Bogdanovic is another guy who, you know, it did so well with the Pacers, but I saw him come up through with Brooklyn, and just I'm just really excited about some of those new pieces they have, what Quinn Snyder is able to do with them. I think they've, you know, really been coming on, but I think this could really change the complexion of potentially what they could do this year and just moving forward.
Okay, I also have a couple. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Chris.
No, let me just say about Milwaukee. Like, John Horst won Executive of the Year this year, and I thought if they had been able to, you know, do that voting after the season, I mean, Masai Ujiri would have run away with it because of what happened with Toronto. But John Horst won Executive of the Year, and he's followed that up with just an unbelievable offseason. I mean, they made the move to deal Tony Snell because they needed cap space. They needed the flexibility that came with getting Tony Snell's contract off the books. They sign up Brook Lopez using some of that cap flexibility. And Brook Lopez wanted to be there. I mean, that was that was a mutually beneficial relationship. They get Robin Lopez to sign. And Robin Lopez, I think, would have had more significant offers if he stayed on the market and sort of played that whole thing out. Because Robin Lopez, I know Boston had strong interest in Robin Lopez because he's killed the Celtics and they've got big problems with their front line. But not only do you get that, you get, you know, Brook and Robin Lopez. You make the deal with Malcolm Brogdon, who got a huge number from Indiana. And Malcolm Brogdon's a very good player, but you get picks back in return in that deal. And then you turn around and you sign a guy like Wesley Matthews for the veteran minimum there. And you get George Hill back with your cap flexibility too. I mean, the moves that the Bucks made, I don't know how they could have had a better offseason with all the things that they, all the balls in the air that they had. I had one GM tell me that he thought teams were going to come after Milwaukee, like that they were going to try to pilfer some of these players away and weaken them, both because the Bucks were a threat to win next year and because of the ramifications for Giannis. But you know what John Horst did is really do a really impressive job of not only kind of maintaining most of the status quo, but also maybe bolstering that team with some of the additions that they made.
Okay, okay. I don't want to rain on the Bucks parade going on here, but you said I don't know how they could have had a better offseason. I'll tell you how right now. Keep Malcolm Brogdon. I mean, did you watch the playoffs? I mean, he was way better for them at the end of those games than Eric Bledsoe. I understand it's a big number, and the Bucks are going to, you know, I have a couple teams I don't want to talk about, but let's just talk about the Bucks real quick. The Bucks' success last year, I think, may end up being their own worst enemy, okay? Because this is what happened with Milwaukee. They have the season where they blow out expectations. Giannis is incredible. You know, best team in the league. So what does that mean? That means you have to keep all these guys together, right? But they get expensive. You give Eric Bledsoe an extension. You bring back Brook Lopez for 4 years. You sign Chris Middleton to a max deal. These are all good players. But you have to think now. They're more or less locked into this core. Their flexibility is not great. I mean, they can maybe make some trades. It's not going to be easy for them to be free agent players or anything like that. Is this team, as currently built, going to be a title contender every year? Are you confident in Brook Lopez as their third guy? Are you confident in Eric Bledsoe as their third guy? Are you confident in Chris Middleton as your max player? I mean, that's kind of the trickiness of the NBA salary cap system is, you know, a guy like Chris Middleton is going to make max money, but so is, you know, Klay Thompson. But and obviously they're not equals, but it makes team building very difficult. And I do wonder if the Bucks being so good last year accelerated the front office in a way that put them in maybe a little bit of a disadvantage. I also think letting Brogdon go to me was a mistake. I understand he's making a lot of money. In my opinion, you pay the guys who can't get paid off, played off the floor in the playoffs. You know, you Brogdon is always going to have value, whether it's as a defender, a shooter, a guy who can initiate your offense. And we've now seen Bledsoe 2 years in a row struggle, you know, with those exact same things. So that to me is not insignificant. And obviously this is all going to play out. Maybe I'll be spectacularly wrong, but I do think, you know, you're giving a lot of credit to John Horst, and I don't think it was his decision to let Brogdon walk. I'm sure ownership wasn't thrilled at the prospect of handing out another big contract this summer, but Bledsoe over Brogdon is going to be a decision that the Bucks may have to reckon with at some point. I want to also just throw in two teams who
Let me just answer that real quick. I mean, if they didn't bring George Hill back, I would have a much bigger problem with Malcolm Brogdon getting like allowing Malcolm Brogdon to go in the way they did. Because you're right, Bledsoe, until Bledsoe proves he can be a championship level point guard, even a finals level point guard, he's a liability. And Malcolm Brogdon in those conference finals was, you know, looked like the second best player on the floor. But I mean, it's a $20 plus million per year number for Brogdon when you had so many other guys to go out there and sign. Like I didn't look at this offseason like the Bucks were kind of being cheap. They were being more strategic, I think, than anything else with some of these deals that they made. And they were able to bring back what a team that should be competitive for the number one seed again and should be among the top two or three teams in the East that you would project to come out of it.
Yeah, I don't disagree. Like I said, they were in a tricky spot because they were so good last year. It's almost like you have to bring most of these people back. Even if, you know, I think 12 months ago, I don't think anyone was saying George Hill was going to be a valuable, you know, part of a title team. And I'm not saying that he can't be good again, but it's going to sound like I'm saying the Bucks season was fool's gold. I don't think that. It's just I'm pumping the brakes the tiniest bit on the optimism there, because I think so much of it relies on Giannis being this MVP type player night in and night out. And obviously he's capable of that, but their style of play, as we saw in the playoffs, does create some problems. Go ahead.
And Rowan, they need Sterling Brown and Dante DiVincenzo, two guys to come back as better players. If those guys can take steps forward, I think they'll be okay. Plus, I mean, look, they have to put together a competitive team to get Giannis to sign his name on that line in next summer. And I think they did that. I think what they did this offseason, I think it makes it incredibly likely that Giannis signs an extension next summer.
Yeah, and I'll just add to that. I think everyone assumed and knew that Middleton would be signed to the max and brought back, but I think he was the ultimate must-do for them in doing so, in thinking about Giannis and the next year. The one thing I'll say, though, we have seen Giannis come back each and every season a exponentially better player. Yeah. And so there's not everyone that you could always anticipate that with. I think he's one guy who, that's what I would expect out of him, on top of the fact that now Mike Budenholzer will have, you know, a whole year with these guys, an off season, another training camp to get ready. I think that will factor in, and I think there's something to be said for chemistry and how much all of this group and this core group genuinely played for each other, seemed to care about each other, had a lot of trust in one another. So I think the better part of them bringing them back, I'm high on them. Would have loved to seen them figure out a way to bring Brogdon back, but that didn't seem very likely. So I'm high on where they're at in what they'll, what they have the opportunity to do this upcoming year.
So I wanted to talk quickly about two teams that have really done nothing in free agency. And that's the Rockets and the Nuggets. Where are they going to fall in the West hierarchy? I'm personally, as we know, no pun intended, still very high on the Nuggets. Those are my guys. I'm a big Jamal Murray, Garrius, Nikola Jokic fan. I'm staying up late to watch all their games. I'm personally ready to argue that, you know, we don't know. Let me be clear. We don't know where Kawhi Leonard is signing. He hasn't decided as of yet. So what I'm about to say may sound crazy in a few hours, but I'm ready to argue for the Nuggets as the number one team in the West right now. I know a lot of people think the Jazz have made that leap, you know, but the Warriors are going to take a step back. The Rockets, I think, are going to be very good, but Sarah just talked about chemistry. They still hate each other. They still have, like, they need a lot of group therapy sessions if they're going to sort things out. Denver is bringing back the core of a team that was outstanding last year that dealt with a ton of injuries during the regular season. Millsap missed significant time, Jokic missed time, Gary Harris missed time, and they still put together a great regular season. I think they're going to be very good. You know, Will Barton, I think, was out second or third game of the year. They're going to be very good. Michael Porter Jr. is a wild card for them. They need a perimeter, you know, swing type guy, someone who can play both forward positions. They haven't had that, and if he can give them anything, I think Denver's going to be really, really interesting. What the Nuggets lacked was playoff experience. Those guys hadn't, you know, been through something like that together. And they went through maybe the best test they could have gone, which was 2 7-game series against experienced opponents. I'm really, really high on the Nuggets. Even though they haven't done anything, I don't know that anyone's eclipsed them yet in my mind. The Lakers have three guys on the roster right now. They have a lot of work to do if they don't get Kawhi. So, you know, the Rockets and Nuggets to me are kind of lurking as sleeper teams right now.
Yeah, and Sarah, I look at the Rockets, and I don't really know what's true and what's not about, you know, just their level of disagreement within that organization. I've said on, I think, the last 4 podcasts, like, the Rockets have to figure this Mike D'Antoni stuff out. Like, they've got to, you know, decide if he's their guy, and if he is, you've got to give him an extension so he can go out there and continue to flesh out his assistant coaching ranks. But if you're Houston, you got to look around and say you've got continuity, you've got 2 stars. And I think Clint Capella, with Golden State out of the mix, becomes much more playable against those top-tier teams, whether it's Denver or Utah or these other teams that have more traditional bigs that are out there. I mean, you've got to feel pretty good if you're Houston, despite the fact that you've done nothing, that you're a threat to win the Western Conference next year.
I would think so. And based on Rohan saying this is all before we know what happens with Kawhi Leonard, I think you feel really good about it. I believe Daryl Morey feels really good about it. I agree with you. You need to make decisions on Mike D'Antoni and give him an extension if he's your guy, or figure out how exactly you want to proceed with that. I'm fascinated as an outsider looking in, not only the dynamics of James Harden and Chris Paul, which is well documented. Does anything play into all of these relationships with all the discussion about Clint Capella and Eric Gordon and PJ Tucker and potentially, you know, being on the block because they wanted to bring in Jimmy Butler? Like, does all of that factor in? And then on top of the fact of going in, and I think part of this too is D'Antoni, you're looking at the roster you have, but what weighs into you saying, okay, we are going to stylistically change how we play, or approaching what they do offensively, or how much of what they've been doing and the talk about, does it translate into the postseason? Like, do you adjust anything and change anything? And I don't have the answers to that. I don't know how you go about not only mending, if needed, the relationship between Chris Paul and James Harden. And I know PJ Tucker came out and said, me and Chris argue more than, you know, him and James. Like, it's less about having respect for, it's about respect on the floor and respect in how you play. And I think a lot of that comes down to, for better or worse, your actual system and how you're going to play and how guys are going to buy into that. Because you don't need to be best friends. You don't even need to be friends off the court.
Mannix and I aren't friends and we do this podcast
together. I'm with you too. Yeah. I almost felt like Mannix, I took the DeAndre Jordan route of I'm just friends with you so I can get on the podcast.
I have a Houston fun fact for you guys, by the way. Houston is going to be the last team in NBA history that beat the Warriors when Steph, Clay, and KD all started a game. Why is that significant to me? For 2 years, they were very close to beating this unbeatable juggernaut, and that gave them a lot of problems. Now, granted, they were tailor-made to kind of try to beat that team. But the second half of last season, going into the playoffs, there were a lot of positive signs for the Rockets. And I think a lot of the issues they're having stem from back-to-back just debilitating playoff defeats in ways that were like so uniquely and deeply upsetting that teams don't always go through. So I do wonder if, you know, this fresh start, no longer having that Warriors boogeyman, also kind of helps those relationships along.
It's possible. Now, before we go, I don't want to date this podcast, because by the time we get off the air, Kawhi could decide where he's going to sign. But I want to ask you both this: the Lakers could have. They could
I
have
think
gone
we're already down that road.
Yeah. They could have said they sign Kawhi Leonard, or they could have gone out and gotten three or four guys with that cap space to flesh out the roster. They elected to wait for Kawhi Leonard, regardless of what happens. Sarah, did the Lakers do the right thing in making their pitch and going after hard for Kawhi Leonard?
Yes. And regardless of what happens, it's far and few between you come across a talent as special as Kawhi Leonard. I too think if they would have decided, let's split it up and let's get quality players, let's fill out the roster. And we think that's better. Look at the example Toronto set. You could win a title with depth. That's a factor. We know how the Western Conference is going to be such a challenge as it always is. So the thought of load management, or the thought of how do we handle Anthony Davis and LeBron, the regular season is going to matter in the sense of how you finish and where seeding and standings lie. However, as we sit here today, not knowing Kawhi's decision, but how close and how viable it seems the Lakers have to getting him, I do believe that, because I think if you have the opportunity to get a player of his caliber, and you're not just thinking about next season or, oh, playing alongside LeBron and Anthony Davis. Yes, of course, that matters these next few seasons, but once LeBron decides to retire, if that ever happens, but just looking towards your future in the big picture, I think that is a gamble and a risk that you absolutely have to take.
Yeah, to go back to my, you know, menu analogy from earlier, what do I do when I can't decide? I just order like a bunch of things that I like, and I'm like, you know what, I'm going to eat one of these.
Rohan. Yeah. We should go out to dinner
yes,
together.
Yes, definitely. Just the safe route, you know? We're gonna get a lot of different things to eat, and it's going to be great. I know this is good. That's what I would have done if I was Rob Pelinka. I would have gone after Danny Green. I would have gone after Pat Beverly. I would have gone after Terrence Ross and say, I know what these guys are. I know what they can do. It's safe. I feel comfortable. I'm going to go home satisfied. Okay. Having said that, as boomer bust as this has gotten, because guys are off the board now, there's like, it's slim pickings left for the Lakers. I respect the hell out of what they're doing, because I thought they had no chance at Kawhi Leonard. Just the way Kawhi Leonard's career has played out, he did not seem like the kind of guy for a second who wanted to go play with LeBron and Anthony Davis. I think he's always wanted to beat LeBron. He doesn't seem like the kind of guy who wants to be his teammate. I don't know if LeBron is Jedi mind tricking him to thinking, this is going to be your team. I'm out of here in 2 years. I just want to make movies. Like, you can do all that, you know, whatever you want. I don't know how they've sold him on this. I don't know how they've pitched him on this. But I respect what the Lakers are doing, because, like Sarah said, you know, I can sit here and say, take the safe route, just get a bunch of role players and you'll be a title favorite. It's done. If you end up with these three guys, I don't think they you know, get 2016 Warriors status. I think they're closer to the Heat when LeBron signed than the Warriors when Kevin Durant signed. But if you end up with LeBron, Anthony Davis, and Kawhi, you got to take that chance. You just have to. I didn't think they had a prayer at signing him, but he seems to be seriously considering it from everything we've heard, and maybe even leaning that way. So yes, they did the right thing, because he is. We just saw what he did, not playing basketball, you know, for a year. He just came back and won Finals MVP. We saw what he's capable of. You take that risk no matter what.
Yeah, I agree. They did do the right thing. You know, Kawhi Leonard at 28 is a, you know, once every or two or three times a generation type of player who can grow alongside Anthony Davis once LeBron is eventually gone. But the phrase boomer bust is applicable here. You know, you get Kawhi Leonard and you've got something going. You don't. And it's not hyperbole to say there are literally no avenues for you to, you know, get that next big piece. You can't trade for him because you have no assets, and you can't go sign him, at least not for a couple of years, because the 2020 free agent class right now isn't very good. So the stakes could not be higher for the LA Lakers based on the decision that they made to wait. All right.
I love
so
that,
Rohan,
by the way.
Sarah,
I just want to
always
out.
Appreciate it.
Oh, okay.
Thank you for joining me.
How about Chris? What's going
on? Rohan was still talking.
Yeah, Chris, I was going to throw in one last little thing here, and then you just
sorry. Here we go. I didn't hear you.
I was just going to say, like, I just hope everyone takes a moment to appreciate how absurd the Lakers' summer has been and how entertaining this is. Like, this is as high stakes as it gets, baby, and I love it. It's incredibly, like, this is as fun as literally waiting for someone to sign a piece of paper could possibly be. It's incredible, and I just hope everyone takes a moment to appreciate that. That's it.
Well, all right, then a moment of silence.
There we go.
Lakers offseason and how much fun it's been. Guys, always appreciate your time. Thanks for both of you joining me here in studio.
Thanks for having us.
Anytime, Chris.